Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. In today's podcast, in this episode, we are going to cover six of the presentations from the annual meeting of the ECTRIMS, or the European MS meeting, together with ACTRIMS that was held in Milan this year, and they called it MS Milan 2023. It was held the 11th through the 13th of October in Milan, Italy, and there was a lot of great news, so enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
So the question arose whether fenebrutinib was associated with the rapid MS lesion reduction or not. And we know that fenebrutinib is a little bit unique in that it penetrates the cerebral spinal fluid, or the CSF, at sufficiently high levels to reduce activation of B cells and the microglia in vitro. So these are some of the early findings from the ongoing phase 2 study. It's called FenOpta. And yeah, the early data seems to show that it might actually impact mechanisms underlying chronic progressive disease biology and multiple sclerosis, or MS. So the study did meet its primary endpoint, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. It had a 69% reduction in the number of new T1 lesions at weeks 4 through 12. Fenebrutinib, it's a brutin tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and it's implicated in the peripheral and CNS inflammation in MS. And it's a therapeutic target for relapsing as well as progressive disease. Fenebrutinib, it's a potent, it's highly selective, it's non-covalent, it's a reversible BTK inhibitor that's evaluated for multiple sclerosis. And the aim of this particular phase 2 FenOpta trial was to establish the safety and efficacy of fenebrutinib in RMS and early impact on MRI outcomes and soluble markers of disease activity and progression. The results were presented by the first author, who is Professor Amit Bar-Or, a well-known person in the field of multiple sclerosis. He's at the University of Pennsylvania in the United States. 106 RMS patients participated. They were between 18 and 55 years of age, and they had expanded disability status scale score between 0 and 5.5. They were randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to fenebrutinib at 200 milligrams twice daily. There were 70 of them, or placebo. There were 36 of those participants for 12 weeks. The primary efficacy endpoint was the total number of new T1 gadolinium-enhancing lesions at weeks 4, 8, and 12. In 11 of the participants, fenebrutinib concentrations in the CSF had been measured, and after 12 weeks of continuous administration, the median concentration was 47.4 nanograms per milliliter. So according to Professor Bar-Or, all 11 patients had values within the active range, which was, you know, above the IC50, and the CSF to plasma ratio indicated CSF penetration. The study met its primary endpoint with a 69% reduction in the adjusted rate of new T1 gadolinium lesions at weeks 4, 8, and 12 combined, highly significant p-value. The reduction in the adjusted rate of new or enlarging T2 weighted lesions at weeks 4 to 12 combined was 74%, again, significant. And the adjusted rate of new T1 hypo-intense lesions, which was just an exploratory endpoint, at weeks 4 to 12 combined was 64% reduced. A rapid onset of action was observed, with relative reductions of 92% and 90% in T1 gadolinium lesions at week 4, and relative reductions of 90% and 95% in T2 lesions at weeks 8 and 12, respectively. Professor Bar-Or added that no new safety concerns were identified, and results were really consistent with previous findings, indicating a potentially favorable benefit-to-risk ratio of fenebrutinib. The SPAM trial, believe it or not, it's actually called that, was presented by Dr. Christine Lepron-Frenet from the CHU de Nice in France, and was a French retrospective multi-center register study evaluating the long-term impact of the early use of high-efficacy therapy, which they call HET, on the occurrence of secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, which is the acronym SPMS. After 10 years, she reported that only 8% of patients treated with HET converted to SPMS, which is pretty good. It was lower than expected when looking at the known natural history of multiple sclerosis, making these authors kind of advocate that the early introduction of HET in younger patients may be really worthwhile. So this so-called SPAM study, great name, aimed to evaluate the long-term effect of this early HET intervention on the risk of transition to SPMS. The study included 2,237 patients from 34 French centers. Participants had to have an EDSS score of less than or equal to 4. They had to initiate AHET within the first 5 years after the clinical MS onset and remain on treatment for at least 1 year. At HET initiation, mean age was 31.6 years, and the median EDSS score was 2.0. Mean disease duration had been about 2 years, and the mean follow-up was 5.8 years. The most commonly prescribed HETs were natalizumab at 48.1%, fingolimod at 36.2%, and ocrelizumab at 13.7%. After 10 years, 59.2% of the participants were still using the same HET. At 5 and 10 years, 3.8 and 8.0% of the patients had developed SPMS, respectively. Whether HET was used as a first or second line treatment did not seem to make a difference for the prognosis, and women had a lower risk of developing SPMS than men overall, with a hazard ratio of 0.64, which seems awfully high. Older age and EDSS score of greater than or equal to 1, as well as the use of oral HETs, all seem to increase the risk of SPMS. After 2 years, 50.1% of the participants had reached no evidence of disease activity, and 24.1% had mild evidence of disease activity at that point. Neither no evidence or mild evidence were associated with SPMS risk. On the other hand, progression independent of relapse activity, progression independent of any inflammatory activity, and relapse-associated worsening were all associated with risk. Dr. Lebrun-Frenet stressed that introducing HET in younger patients before any residual disability based on EDSS and not on relapses or disease duration and or MRI features seemed to be associated with a lower risk of SPMS. Interesting work. There has been considerable talk at all the conferences lately about smoldering inflammation and what that means. How early can we actually detect that? Is that part of the continuum of MS, or is it just a subset of patients? And this next study, which was presented by Dr. Markus Matilainen of the University of Turku in Finland, seemed to indicate that smoldering inflammation is detectable even in the earliest stages of multiple sclerosis. This Finnish study evaluated the presence of smoldering inflammation associated with chronic lesions throughout the various stages of MS. And Dr. Matilainen and colleagues, they use concurrent MRI and PET imaging with a radioligand, which binds to the 18 kilodalton size translocator protein, which is known as TSPO, and that is a biomarker for activated microglia. Newly diagnosed patients and patients with the longest disease duration of over 20 years had the highest amount of PRLs. Microglial activation in the normal appearing white matter, or NAWM, correlated with disease duration, disability, and age. The proportion of rim lesions with active microglia correlated with disease duration. Dr. Matilainen noted that the proportion of patients with no active rim lesions was lowest in the longest disease duration group, but the proportion of patients with at least 7 active rim lesions was highest in that same group. Dr. Matilainen concluded that the lesions with high TSPO PET detectable microglial activity at the rim were more prevalent in late stages of the disease, while prevalence of PRLs was also high among patients with the shortest disease duration. Thus, the main takeaway message, according to the presenter and his colleagues, is that the smoldering inflammation is actually already present, even at the earliest stages of multiple sclerosis. Well, that might be the beginning of a great hypothesis. Some positive news from phase 2 results for the first-in-class anti-CD40L antibody. So this is a story about frexalimab. It's the first second-generation CD40L targeting monoclonal antibody evaluated for the treatment of multiple sclerosis, and it blocks the co-stimulatory CD40 and CD40 ligand pathway, which regulates both the innate and adaptive immune responses. There were 129 participants in this study. It's a phase 2 study with no particular acronym. It was randomized in a 2:2:1 ratio to either high-dose frexalimab, low-dose frexalimab, or a placebo. In the 12-week double-blinded period, the high-dose group demonstrated an 89% reduction in new gadolinium-enhancing lesions, which is significant, and of those 129 participants, 125 entered the ongoing open-label part of that study. After 24 weeks, 96% of the participants continued high-dose frexalimab, and they had no new gadolinium T1 lesions. 91% had no new or enlarging T2 lesions. In the low-dose frexalimab arm, these percentages were 80% and 74%, which kind of, you know, seems to suggest that there's a dose dependency. In participants who switched from placebo to high-dose frexalimab, the monthly count of new gadolinium-positive T1 lesions decreased from 2.3 at week 12, so at their baseline, to 0.4 at week 24. And from those who switched to low-dose frexalimab, the baseline was 3.7, and it went down to 0.6, so even more dramatic, perhaps. Circulating markers of CXCL13 and neurofilament light chain decreased over 24 weeks. There were no new safety concerns, which is always great news, and the most common adverse events, which was more than 10% in any group, were COVID-19, which is either mild or moderate, nasopharyngitis, or headache. The authors concluded that their findings provide proof of concept for targeting CD40 ligand, or CD40L, in multiple sclerosis and support the development of frexalimab as a potential high-efficacy, non-depleting MS therapy. This was a late-breaking abstract by Professor Vermeersch. What about highly effective therapies in children with multiple sclerosis? We don't know much about that, do we? So this was a great talk. It was held by Naïl Benalagou from Nantes University in France. It was a retrospective observational study. And Benalagou and colleagues compared the real-world efficacy of highly effective therapies, or HET, and mildly effective and moderately effective therapies, MET, on disease activity and evaluated treatment succession. They used data from 36 French multiple sclerosis expert centers participating in the French MS registry. The study population consisted of 530 treatment-naive children under the age of 18 with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, or RRMS, who initiated MET, there were 422 of them, or HET, 108 of them, between 2010 and 2022. For data analysis, an innovative parametric time-to-event model was used to estimate the dynamics of event rate, adjusting for confounders. The results showed that after a median follow-up of 5.8 years, both HET and MET reduced the risk of first relapse during the first 2 years of treatment. Over a 5-year period, HET reduced the risk of first relapse with 54% compared with MET, which had an adjusted hazard ratio of 0.46. In these first 5 years, the yearly relapse risk was 20% in the MET group and 8% in the HET group. These results were confirmed by a 66% reduction of new T2 and gadolinium-enhancing lesions with a HET at 2 years, measured with MRI in 300 patients, with an overall response of 0.34. And there was no difference in expanded disability status scale score progression. MET was associated with a 6-fold higher risk of discontinuation within 2 years, with a hazard ratio of 5.97, so nearly 6, yeah. MET was associated with a 6-fold higher risk of discontinuation within 2 years, mostly due to inefficacy or intolerance. At 5 years, 86.1% of the children had discontinued MET and 50.7% HET. Overall, a HET strategy was sustained in 92, or at 85% of the children, and 68.9% of the children were on MET switched to HET. I think overall we conclude from this data that there is some room for MET and HET in treating children with this disease, but there's a lot more questions than answers at this point. But this French nationwide cohort really took the trouble to analyze their data thoroughly, and that's much appreciated. Thank you. we're going to just talk about one talk about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or MSOD. In NMOSD, we note that a subset is positive for the biomarker aquaporin 4. And this was a question, this particular study that we're going to talk about is looking at the safety of C5 complement inhibitors in this aquaporin 4 subset of NMOSD patients. Rituximab, it's often prescribed off-label in the early stages of aquaporin 4 NMOSD. However, patients often need to switch to more efficacious therapies to prevent relapse. Our C5 complement 5 inhibitors, or C5 ITs, are often used. And this is the safety outcomes from the PREVENT and the CHAMPION NMOSD studies combined. This was a pooled post-hoc analysis which compared the safety outcomes between participants who had and had not received prior rituximab treatment within 3 to 12 months of starting a C5-IT. The authors analyzed treatment-emergent adverse events, treatment-emergent serious adverse events, and deaths or withdrawals due to treatment-emergent serious effects. Of the 154 actively treated patients in the PREVENT and CHAMPION NMOSD trials, 38, or one quarter of them basically, had used rituximab within 3 to 12 months prior to their first C5-IT dose. 116, so three quarters of them, had not. In both cases, the mean number of relapses in the year prior to the screening to the trial was 2.0, and they also had similar historical annualized relapse rates. The incidence of patients experiencing adverse events, either serious or normal, was generally similar in patients with prior and no prior rituximab use. Treatment-emergent adverse events at 94.7% versus 90.5%, for example. For the serious adverse events, it was 21.2% versus 24.1%, respectively. So really no difference.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.